The Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series.
Hello and welcome to the Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series. I'm Daniel Norcross. In each episode, acclaimed writers, scientists and entrepreneurs reveal what inspires them. And today, I'm delighted to be joined by a geneticist and host of numerous programs, including Radio 4's Start the Week and The Curious Cases of Rutherford and Fry. He's produced several science documentaries and wrote Control, The Dark History and Troubling Present of Eugenics, the Sunday Times bestseller How to Argue with a Racist, A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived, and most recently, a children's book, Where Are You Really From? He is a lecturer in genetics and society at University College London. Welcome to Inspired Minds, Adam Rutherford.
Hello, Dan. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I'm very well. Now, what we do here, at the start of every episode of the Inspired Minds podcast, we ask our guest, what is inspiration? How do you get it? How important is it? Do you get it?
Yeah, I mean, one of the funny things about academia is that you just get to... I mean, there's a lot wrong with academia and there's a lot of admin and there's a lot of systems which barely work. But the thing which really gets you out of bed in the morning is just coming up with ideas. And then you talk to some of the cleverest people you know, and then you go away and you do it. And so there's a lot of sort of talking about clever things. I'm writing a book about sport at the moment and the science of sport and a lot of the genetics and physiology and things like that. And because I talk about race quite a lot in my work, I was considering the fact that certain ethnic groups in certain countries dominate in certain specific sports. And this is often used by racists or people who aren't racist, but don't have a sort of really robust scientific understanding, which is most people, why that would be the case. And if that sort of justifies ideas of scientific racism from the past. And basically, we were sitting around and I was talking about it. And one of my colleagues just went, well, I think I can model this. And he went away for the weekend and came back on Monday and said, I think I found out something which may be a completely novel result. I can't tell you what the result is yet because it's not published. But it's moments like that when you just go, this is a ridiculous job. You know, you just get paid to, well, not very much, but you get paid to sort of sit around and think of stuff and then tell other people about it. So I think that's the real inspiration is, you know, what are we going to find out that no one else has ever known today?
Well, you sort of have to do that on a weekly basis, don't you? Because you have your podcast with Hannah Fry and you get different questions that are sent to you. Obviously, you must choose which question it is that you want to answer because you must get loads of these questions come through from listeners. And presumably, is it a kind of an inspiration that comes from the question?
Yeah, sometimes. So we tend to get, like, there's a range of types of questions that get sent in. And about, I'd say about 70% of them are, I've just split up with my boyfriend stroke girlfriend, can you help? To which the answer is no, not really. It's not that kind of show. But then you get really specific ones, which are things like, you know, well, how do we know that the universe is 13.84 billion years old? And you can sort of dive into that and look at the latest science and tell a story about that. But some of the best ones they either come from children or they have a sort of naivety about them. Like one of my absolute favorites was, what is the smallest dinosaur? Right. And that was it. That was the whole question. And you might sort of just toss that out because that seems like quite a prosaic question that you actually can just say, well, the answer is Epidexepteryx. I think that's how you pronounce it.
Can you?
But actually what it allows you to do is it opens the door on asking questions about why things are the way they are. Why is anything the size that it is? Why was the largest land animal that's ever existed a dinosaur? What is the smallest? Why are animals the size that they are? And how did that happen? And then we ended up, you know, just getting onto, well, actually the smallest dinosaurs that ever existed are probably still alive today. And they're tiny little hummingbirds because birds are directly descended from dinosaurs. So it becomes an enormously fun thing when someone asks a what you might park as being a naive or even a stupid question. You know how they say that there are no stupid questions. So that isn't true. I get asked a lot of stupid questions a lot of time. But simple questions are often the most insightful.
Now, you've mentioned in there genetics, and I'm going to use that as our jumping off point because you've talked about this a lot, but there is a simple piece of mathematics which is absolutely mind-blowing. That it effectively, when you write it and articulate it, it makes absolute sense. And it sort of staggers me that I had never thought about it until you brought it up. But that you don't have to go back very far in history, human history, but let's just start with European history, to discover a massive interconnectedness between all the people on this continent. And you've linked this a lot to programs that are really big right now, like Who Do You Think You Are, for example, which is one of these wonderful programs where Danny Dyer discovers that he's related to royalty. And we all find that magnificent because we feel this great sort of pull towards our ancestors. But in the way that you have described the maths of this, it's rather deflating in a way. can you explain what it is that I'm talking about here?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's an interesting thing that we crave narrative, and we crave narrative satisfaction in our own stories. I'm not an expert on the sort of scholarship of storytelling or the psychology of belonging. They're not my fields. But I think that, you know, life is complex and weird and hard, and then you die. And so we clutch onto things that give us a sense of who we are and where we fit into the grand narrative of families and genealogies and life and evolution and all that sort of stuff. The trouble is that it's science's job to, you know, ruin good stories with hard, boring facts, right? So when you do genealogy, or when you watch programs like Who Do You Think You Are, which I love, right? They tell you a story which goes, well, gone through your family tree and we've looked at your ancestors, and that's interesting because they're people, and they are people of interest in history who've done things, or else they wouldn't be on the program if they were just really boring people who died without leaving any trace, which is, let's face it, most people in history. So if you can pin your ancestry to someone famous or infamous or royal, as in the case of Danny Dyer, they showed that he was 21 generations from Edward III. You know, this working class Canning Town Cockney boy who discovers live on this program that he's actually descended from royalty. He said in response to finding that out, he said a couple of things. One was, I'm going to treat myself to a massive rough, which is a good thing. You know, it's funny. Like, I actually found out by Googling it that roughs are about 2 centuries later. So, you know, we'll let that go. But he said, I can't compute this in my brain. My blood is his blood. And I was sitting there and I was writing one of my books about genetics and history and genealogy, which is mostly what I write about at the time. And I did think to myself, well, I wonder if I can calculate it in my brain. And what I meant by that was, what is the probability that anyone born in the 1970s, as I was, as Danny Dyer was, is also related to Edward III? And it became, it was a little mini project, took about a week to do, and I wrote it up and included it in the book. But basically, the answer comes out as 100%. The probability that you, Daniel Norcross, are descended from Edward III is 100%. It's actually like 99.99 with about 27 nines after the decimal point. And the same for me, and the same with anyone who has any longstanding English heritage or British heritage, in fact. And it is all predicated on the fact that everyone has two parents, right? That is a non-negotiable fact of biology for the last 2 billion years or so. So if you've got two parents, then they have two parents each, which is 4 grandparents, which means 8 great-grandparents and 16 great-great-great-grandparents. And basically, you double the number of ancestors you have every generation you go back into the past. If you keep doing that, by the time you get 1,000 years ago, which is 40 generations, in genealogy, we take 25 years approximately to be one generational time. So you go back 40 generations, which is 1,000 years, then the number of ancestors that one person has 1,000 years ago is just over a trillion, well, 99 billion over a trillion, 1 trillion, 99 billion, and the rest of it. And you think, well, hold on a minute. That's like 10 times more people than have ever existed. So how can that be true? And the answer to that is, well, it's that many positions on your family tree, not that many individuals. Because what you find is that your family tree branches out from you, and then it begins to straighten up, and then it begins to collapse in on itself. And so some people will occupy, in your family tree, will occupy multiple positions. Your great-great-great-great-great-grandmother might be your great-great-great-great-grandmother twice or 3 times. I mean, the joke I always make, which is slightly unfair, but I can say it because I am actually from Suffolk, is that, well, basically that. But it's also, you know, all people are inbred to a certain degree. But what you actually find from the maths is that it's called pedigree collapse, is the technical term we use for it. What we find is that after a few centuries, all lines of all family trees begin to cross through all individuals. And it means that Edward III, if he has living descendants today, which he does because Danny Dyer has done his family tree and has demonstrated that, it actually means that everyone is descended from Edward III. If you go a little bit further, and you mentioned Europe at the beginning, the figurehead we use is Charlemagne, the first Holy Roman Emperor. Now, we know that Charlemagne has living descendants today because people have done his family tree. Cool fact is that Christopher Lee, the great actor, Sauron, I'm not really a Lord of the Rings fan, you know the one, Count Dooku, Dracula.
I know the one.
Lord Summerisle.
I think more of Hammer horror films and The Wicker Man, but yeah, exactly, we can go with Lord of the Rings if you like.
His mother was minor Italian royalty, so they knew their family tree back several centuries, and he knew he was descended from Charlemagne, and weirdly did a heavy metal album just before he died about Charlemagne. It's well worth looking that up on YouTube and having a listen to it because it's nuts. Anyway, so if we know that Charlemagne has got living descendants today, what the math says is that Charlemagne is the ancestor of everyone in Europe today. It's so counterintuitive. I mean, I've said this hundreds of times. This is like a core piece of my academic output, and I've said it in public stages, and I teach it to my undergraduates, and I've written it in books. And every time I say it, I think, that's bonkers, isn't it? I mean, does it make sense? And you sit there thinking, can that possibly be true? And then I go through the maths again and again and again, and it is true. It's not conceptually true. It's not theoretically true. It is literally, actually true.
Of course, the converse of this, I say it shouldn't be a converse, but it should be an addition to this, is that presumably we're all related to like Louis the Mad and Vlad the Impaler, and Gustavus Adolphus, and Christie, the killer, John Christie. I mean,
well, he's a bit more recent.
Right, but presumably, I mean, he's a cousin in some sense, because if he's related to Charlemagne and Edward III, and I'm related to Charlemagne and Edward III, then he's some kind of cousin of mine.
Well, the truth is that I think most people in Britain are something like fourth or fifth cousins anyway. I mean, there's a very low chance that me and you are not fifth cousins, just by the fact we are British men. And that's the same for most English or British people, because you know when you do your family trees, or sometimes if you might have done like one of those genetic ancestry tests, and I've done a few of them for professional reasons because I'm pretty cynical about them on the whole. But when it presents you with relatives who are other paying customers, well, I've got a 50% match with a man called David Rutherford, who is my father, and that's exactly what you expect. There's a first cousin on there where you get a 1/8 genetic match. And after that, I think there's something like 2,500 people who are considered within my genetic family as a result of doing these tests. And every single one of them is a third, fourth, fifth, or sixth cousin. That's just a tiny proportion of the people on the database, which is a tiny proportion of people who exist. But basically, relatedness, genetic relatedness, is really close in immediate family. So mothers and fathers, siblings, maybe first cousins and uncles. But after that, it just drops off a cliff. You know, the genetic similarity between a third or fourth cousin and me is like less than 1%. It's meaningless. And when you draw the family tree out and you actually look at it and go, oh, yeah, well, you go 1, 2, 3, 4 generations back and then follow that line down 4 generations. And this person is my, you know, third or fourth cousin. You've got literally tens of thousands of fourth cousins. But again, we sort of latch onto these family stories and say, well, last week, who was it? It was, I think it was Tilda Swinton. They did her family tree and she's descended from Robert the Bruce. If Tilda Swinton is descended from Robert the Bruce, so are you, Daniel Norcross, and most of the listeners here.
I feel his blood coursing through my veins every minute of the day.
But when they do Who Do You Think You Are, and they identify the one ancestor who's a royal or a duke, or the men always tend to be royals or dukes, and the women always tend to be chambermaids. This is why I feel some affinity to owning a large country pile in that.
What does this say, though, about race generally? And, you know, you've written so much about race, and, you know, a book, How to Argue with a Racist. And race is such a potent stick with which one group in power can beat another group in power. But the implications of what you've written are that race is really a sort of social construct? I mean, is it, does it have any meaning in science?
I mean, the simple answer to that is no, not really at all. So the history, I won't go into the deep history, but a thing that many people don't know, because it's not well taught, although it is well understood, is that the sort of categorizations that we describe as race today were basically invented in the 18th century by European scientists. And at that point, they were using these crude categorizations, mostly based on skin color, pigmentation, as part of the justification of the political ideology of European expansion, right? And this is the birth of biology. So the biology emerges not in parallel with this European expansion and colonization, but in service of it. And so for the next 300 years, we've got a picture of humanity, which we now refer to as scientific racism, but there are groups of people who have different lineages, and their physical characteristics, mostly skin color and hair color, but also some physical characteristics, are immutable, right? So they're locked in and they're essential. In order to be a person of this race, you have these characteristics. And towards the end of the 19th century, when it sort of began when Darwin came along and described evolution, but then into the era of the 20th century when genetics became the dominant form of biology, what we then, over the course of the 20th century, showed is that the true metric of human similarity and difference is at a genetic level. And once we could read DNA and read the genome, we could answer the question of how do we categorize humans? Or can we categorize humans? And the answer was very clearly that the racial categorizations that had been used for the previous 300 or 400 years did not correspond in any meaningful way with the underlying biology, which is at a genetic level. But we continue to use race. We say people are black or white, or terms that are no longer in use, but we would say East Asian today, although that's a relatively, you know, that's one that's only been around for a couple of decades. So these are broad brush ways that we use in order to categorize people that don't have much of a biological utility to them. So that's what we mean when we say race is a social construct. But there's a really, really important corollary to this, which is that saying it's a social construct doesn't mean it's unimportant, because almost every relationship you have with another human during the course of your life will be socially mediated and not biologically. But then there are consequences to the social construction of race, which are biologically meaningful. So, for example, in the West, in the UK, being of a racialized group, such as South Asian or of broadly Indian descent or of Black British descent, those people tend to be in the lowest socioeconomic bracket. And the highest correlate with in medicine is with socioeconomic status. Poverty and disease go hand in hand. So you do see an increase in the amount of diseases, in infectious diseases. And this is what happened during COVID in groups that are racialized. So it looks like there's a biology that is inherent, but actually it is the social imposition of a racial classification that has biological consequences in the form of medicine. So, you know, anyway, I could literally talk about this for 20 hours because that is one of the modules I run at UCL, and I won't. But trying to understand the history and why race exists as a concept and what it actually means when we say it's a social construct and the consequences of that are not just sort of academic interest. They're fundamentally important for understanding things like medicine, right? And for treating people who are actually ill. So that's the sort of serious side of what I do. And that's the serious consequences of looking at genetics and genealogy and Edward III and Charlemagne, all that sort of stuff.
I guess what slightly befuddles me is the point at which humans became, well, created the construct of race. Because I studied classics a lot at university, and
you almost said Oxford then.
I almost said it, but I didn't let it slip.
You know the old joke, how do you know if someone went to Oxford? Oh, don't worry, they'll tell you.
Well, I didn't though, did I? I think you I got away with Oxford. It. until you, university, yeah. But as you're studying it, and this is not in any way to say that ancient civilizations like Greece and Rome were not horrendous and discriminatory, but you don't get the sense of discrimination on race particularly, certainly not on skin color. You get an awful lot more sort of sense of fortune that if you're born within the orbit of the Mediterranean world, you know, if you're fortunate enough to be the ancestors of Aristotle and Plato, and I'm sure you're going to tell us that, you know, Plato was a eugenist himself, but you know, you don't see that kind of fixation with it in quite the same way. So when do you think it happened that it became this stick with which to beat people of different skin tones, which is sort of really what it is, isn't it?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And there is I spend a lot of time in the classics trying to understand the roots of Western thought and Western scientific ideas. And you're exactly right. Whilst recognizing that different pigmentation exists, there isn't the categorization that only really begins to occur in the 18th century in Europe. And yeah, as you say, for most people, for almost everyone in the ancient world, in the classical world, life was awful, short, brutish, and hard. But those sort of battles tended to be cultural or geographical or language-based or religion-based. And there's very little evidence of sort of skin color or morphology, like physical characteristics, being the reason that we're going to separate us from them and then beat the crap out of them. You see lots of descriptions of different skin pigmentations in our very oldest text. So in the Iliad, Odysseus is referred to as being, well, one of the translations is swarthy, so dark-skinned, and his hair changes color. But, you know, there's not you as a classicist will know we mustn't translate word for word. There are interpretive translations, and it's sometimes difficult. You know, there isn't a straightforward English translation for Odysseus's skin and hair color, because he was a pretty complex dude. Sub-Saharan African people are referred to as Aethiops, which literally means blackened face in Greek, and that's where Ethiopia comes from. But there isn't discrimination based on those pigmentations. It really starts with Linnaeus, Carl Linnaeus, the sort of father of modern biology in the 18th century. He drew up the classification system for biology that we still use today, the binomial system where you have genus and species. So Homo sapiens is us, Pan troglodytes is chimpanzees, you know, but the one that I always refer to is gorillas. The genus name is gorilla and the species name is gorilla. So it's gorilla, gorilla. And there's a subspecies, which is the Western Highland gorilla. The subspecies name is gorilla. So I included this in a footnote in a book simply for the exercise of seeing if I could write the word gorilla five times in a row, which I, you know, it's a minor achievement, but
you managed to do it.
As a writer, you need those sorts of things to keep going. Anyway, when it came to the subspecies of humans, Linnaeus designated that there were four, and they were Homo sapiens americanus, meaning the indigenous people of the Americas, Africanus, the sub-Saharan African people, Asiaticus, meaning broadly East Asian people, and Europaeus, meaning white Europeans. Now, the descriptions, when he lists them in his book, Systema Natura, he lists them like that, and then it says, Homo sapiens americanus, red skin, thick black hair, governed by customs and stubborn, right? It says, Homo sapiens asiaticus, yellow skin, thick, straight black hair, haughty, greedy. Homo sapiens africanus, black, silky skin, tight, black, curly hair, lazy, physically strong, but stupid, and sexually capricious. Right? This is in the founding text of biology. And then it says Homo sapiens europaeus, white skinned, blue eyed, intelligent, industrious, creative, and governed by laws. You think, right, so this is the founding text of biology. This is the beginning of the academic study of biology that leads into the era that we're in. And you think, well, A, these physical descriptions are pretty nutty, right? Those skin colors are not actually what skin colors is like.
Red is pushing it, isn't it?
It is a little bit, and also, and as is black. And we now know that there's more variation in pigmentation in the African continent than there is in the rest of the world put together. And, you know, anyone who's ever seen a black person knows this. They don't all have the same pigmentation. And they don't even have the same pigmentation on the same latitudes, you know. But also what you see in that is that from Linnaeus onwards until the 20th century, the classification systems employed were not just classifications, they were hierarchical. And in every single case, without exception, white Europeans are superior. So it is the literal birth of white supremacy. And it, as a scientific racist endeavor, it is a mechanism for politically subjugating the people who are deemed less worthy. The fascinating thing is that the legacy of this type of thinking from the 17th century is present today in every walk of life. I spend a lot of time talking about sport and thinking about cricket and writing about sport. And we've talked a lot in the past about how the dominance of Jamaican or African-American or Canadian-American sprinters in the Olympics. There hasn't been a white guy in the Olympic final 100 meters since.
Oh, is it that Swedish guy?
Nope.
Christian thingamajig? Not Alan Wells.
Alan Wells.
1980, well, that was a boycotted Olympics, exactly. And the Americans weren't even there.
Exactly. Now, so Wells was the last white guy in that race. And it's also the last time that the winner was over 10 seconds. So you look at that data set and you go, well, that's quite compelling, right? Isn't it? I mean, doesn't that say that there's something about being a black man that gives you an innate biological advantage? And that's an appealing and intuitive thought. But then when you scratch the surface and you begin to dig into it, it falls apart as an argument. So the first thing is statistically, the numbers are just hopeless. The numbers there are basically, I think it's 58 men have run that race since 1980, which is not a huge sample size. But what you're actually really selecting for, if you only look at the extreme end of elite athletics, is you're looking at extreme athletes. You've already selected for being a 100 meters runner and all of the cultural and biological things that go with that. But can you say that black people are better at sprinting as a result of looking at the Olympics? No, you can't. It's just it's a meaningless stat, but it appeals to our sort of inbaked sense of, these are ideas that have been a part of our culture for hundreds of years and we can't quite shake them. There's a devastating stat. You're a sports commentator and so you need to know this if you don't already. In America, there was a study done a couple of years ago in which some sociologists looked at 3,000 comments by commentators on elite sports. It was baseball, basketball, and football, when they were referring to either black or white athletes. And in, I think from memory, it was in 70% of the time when they were talking about a black athlete, they would refer to their physicality. And in 70% of the time when they were talking about a white athlete, they would talk about their intellect. And it's just one of those things which is so locked into our thinking that you don't even notice until someone points it out.
The natural athleticism of the West Indian fast bowler was a trope that continued while the West Indians had a lot of very good fast bowlers. It has since then slightly gone into abeyance, but you're absolutely right. And it's what's going to lead me on to asking you about eugenics, because this is a particularly different way of looking at race from, for example, you know, Plato. Plato looks at, I suppose, the body politic, the city-state, and he looks at disease, really, and its elements of the community that he thinks the procreation of them is going to reduce the effectiveness of that society. It's not really about race so much, is it? It's about inabilities, I guess. It's equally repugnant, but it's a slightly different thing. When we get into eugenics in the late 19th century, which you've talked about, as distinct from where we might be going in the 21st century, it very much focuses in on race with devastating consequences, doesn't it?
It's regionally specific. So it's quite interesting that the principles of eugenics, which is that a sort of initially positive movement by people in power to improve the Victorian word, the stock of the British people, or whichever country you're from. So it sets out to be a positive thing. But in order to do that, in order to enact that through selective breeding or historically through infanticide, the first expression of this in the Western canon is in Republic, in Plato's Republic, in which he talks about marriage festivals, where you'd match up gold standard men with gold standard women, and they would have gold standard children. Of course, that never...
A bit like breeding horses sort of thing.
Exactly. It's always a comparison with agriculture. But by the time we get to the 19th and into the 20th century, the British get their asses handed to them in the Boer Wars by what is deemed an inferior race, as deigned by scientific racism of the time. And they begin to think, well, you know, what is wrong with the British people that we can't deal with this inferior race? One of the founders of both biology and eugenics, a guy who is my sort of intellectual great-grandfather at UCL, Carl Pearson, he commented that Jews were a parasitic race that we outnumber, but they are superior to us in so many ways. And so the question becomes for the powerful and the wealthy, how do we maintain our power and our control of the people that we like? And eugenics becomes is that what they turn to. The answer is, well, we encourage the breeding of people that we like and we discourage the breeding of people that we don't like. Now, the problem with that is, in order to enact that, you have to rank people and you have to decide who is desirable and who is undesirable. And instantaneously, every time eugenics is either discussed or enacted all around the world, something like 31 countries had official eugenics policies, although not the UK, it immediately becomes us and them. These are the people we want to breed. Who do we not want to breed? The categories go, well, racialized minorities, immigrants, people with mental health issues, people with physical disabilities. And then it becomes the Jews and people with iterant criminals, alcoholics, sex workers. And every time you see eugenics explored in a nation state, you see exactly the same pattern. The regional differences are that, so for example, in the UK, it was very class-based. So race, as we talk about it today, isn't quite the same as race in the late 19th or early 20th century. And there was a lot of discrimination against the Irish race, right? In America, immigration is the big issue at this time. Something like 15 million people migrated into America in the first decade of the 20th century. And they're mostly Irish, Italians, or Slavic people. And so when the big crisis of immigration hits and the Johnson Act in 1924, effectively, well, the story we tell ourselves is that immigration stopped at that point, but it's not true. It stopped for Irish, Italians, and Slavic people, and it continued at the same rate for Northern European, Germanic, and Scandinavian people. So in America, it was very sort of immigrant-based, and in a much more racially stratified country, that was a much bigger deal. In Germany, it was very medical. So in the Weimar years and into the Third Reich, it was very much initially, it was very much to do with disability. And then one of the crazy things about eugenics in 20th century Germany is that many of the key eugenicists who developed the ideas and the policies were not anti-Semitic until Hitler came to power. And they sort of adopted the virulent anti-Semitism of Hitler in order that the broader eugenics policies that they were interested in could get implemented. So you get these regional specificities, but ultimately, and you said this at the very beginning, you used exactly the right word to describe both racism and eugenics. The key idea is not science, it's power. It's who is in power, who is in control, and who gets to maintain that control. And that's what eugenics was, and in a sense, continues to be today.
Well, in your book on control, which is focuses on eugenics, a tremendous book, which is a very difficult read, throughout. I mean, it's a very easy read because you write it beautifully, but it's a difficult thing to read for different reasons and fairly obvious ones. But by the end of it, you sort of contend that eugenics in the 21st century, which I suppose could be characterized as sort of genetic modification of people yet to be born, not so much to breed out a race, but to breed out perhaps an inherited defect, a concern that might disbenefit the child going forward, your sort of conclusion appears to be that it can't be done anyway, that eugenics is actually, it's insane when looked at through one end of the microscope, namely the sort of 19th century, first half of the 20th century viewpoint. And then in the 21st century, it's actually making promises that it can't even fulfill. Is that a fair summation?
Yeah, I think so. And certainly I try to approach the subject in the 21st century from a very scientific point of view to say, is this possible, right? I use an example that Richard Dawkins tweeted a few years ago now, three or four years ago. Twitter is a medium that Richard Dawkins should really stay away from, but he doesn't, and that's fine. And it gives us all grist for the mill. But he said something like, of course eugenics would work in humans. It works in cows and pigs and roses. Why wouldn't it work in humans? And he then goes on and says, that doesn't mean I endorse it at all. But I thought, I used that as a jumping off place. And I use this for my students. I say, you know, put up the tweet and say, would it? Is that correct? When you dive into the weeds and really think about it, I think it's not true. All it says in a very glib way is that humans are evolved. That's basically, and we are mutable over time. But if you think about like the comparison with agriculture, you mentioned you know, breeding horses, but other comparisons with agriculture have been part of the eugenics ideology since it's existed. Humans are not like purebred animals, which are bred for specific characteristics in specific environments. So yes, a rose is a thing that has been designed by humans over hundreds of years to look exactly as beautiful as the thing that we want in our gardens. But it only can grow in certain soil types. It has to be nurtured. It has to be looked after. A sheep that is bred for wool, or a Frisian that is bred to have giant milky udders, would last approximately 12 hours if you released it into the wild, because it's only been bred to exist in that environment. I took the radical move when I was writing this book and thinking about this as a question to actually speak to some farmers who know an awful lot about evolution, but without necessarily knowing the scientific terms that people like me use. And I spoke to a number of farmers, and one of the things they pointed out is that farming is brutal, right? I mean, it's a thing that involves killing a lot of organisms in order to maintain the healthy ones, in order that those ones can be killed in order to sell them. Now, I am pro-farming, and I'm not saying that as a criticism at all, but the old MacDonald version of farming that we learn as children is a long way from the brutality of how farming actually works. So then you can draw it back to the comparison with humans and say, well, of course it would work for humans because it works for cows. Well, sure, but only if you're willing to murder a lot of people in order to maintain the specific characters in the people that you want to survive to have a specific thing. So no, I mean, I just don't think it is. It's a comparison that people have been making for centuries, but I don't think any of them ever spoke to a farmer about it.
You suddenly reminded me of something I heard you talking about on one of your podcasts, about bananas, and about how basically we'd got down to there only being a couple of types of banana. And because the banana situation was so monocultural, if you like, that once disease hit that banana, it rode roughshod through the banana population, threatening, I think you called it a banana-geddon. Was that right?
Well, if I did, I take full responsibility for that term.
I think you may have done. And it sort of had me in mind of something else you'd written. They all come cascading down on my scientifically illiterate brain, which is also the Habsburgs, whose family tree is way more collapsed, isn't it, than hopefully yours or mine, where they have an awful lot more common ancestors, going back to our original conversation, which then results in an amplification of defects that make it almost impossible for them to adapt to the world around them. So in a strange kind of way, isn't this notion of like breeding the perfect thing utterly counterproductive? Isn't what we've learned from everything that you've been saying that in fact we need the widest multiplicity of genes possible and the biggest family tree?
Yes, that's exactly right. If you were employing a strategy of being the most genetically healthy person that your kids could be, then the thing you should do is try and mate with someone who is as genetically different as possible from you, and someone who has the highest level of genetic diversity in their genomes, which is mostly people from sub-Saharan Africa. So there's a funny stat. When we talk, genetic diversity is a term that we use about how similar genomes are to each other. So an identical twin, two identical twins have, their genetic diversity is extremely low because their genomes are pretty much identical. But when we look at a global scale and we look at the genetic diversity, the true metric of similarity and difference between individuals all over the world, what we find is that almost all genetic variation on Earth is held within people of African people or people of the recent African diasporas. So 85% of genetic diversity is in black people, the categorization of which I've just said, black people. Again, it just goes back to that meaninglessness of the terminology that was embedded back in the 17th century. So there's crazy things emerge from this, which again feel really counterintuitive, but are absolutely true. You take two people from two places in Africa, I don't know, Ethiopia and Uganda, and they are going to be more genetically different from each other than either one of them is to you or me or anyone else on Earth. including like a Chinese man or an Aboriginal Australian or an Indigenous American. And that's because most of the evolution of our species occurred in Africa. And the small group who migrated out of Africa, we call this the out of Africa hypothesis because scientists are very bad at naming things. That is it's like a genetic bottleneck, we call it, but it's a sampling error. It's a statistical sampling error, which did not represent the total amount of the gene pool that it came from. And that population is the origin of everyone else who isn't of recent African descent on Earth. So, I mean, I find this both scientifically interesting, but it also, as a sort of centre-left-leaning person, I find that there is a sort of weirdly liberal bias in reality about relatedness. The differences that have been marked out over the last several thousand years in wars and the creation of race and bloodlines and ancestry, the things that separate us are superficial and they're shallow and they're new and they are not fixed in time and space. What the biology says and what evolutionary biology says is that not only are you and me probably fourth cousins, but everyone on Earth is something like a 12th cousin. And our shared ancestry for all Europeans goes back 1,000 years. And for all humans, it goes back about 4,000 or 5,000 years, which again seems, you know, hugely counterintuitive.
How does that work? Because I come at this from a point of view of scientific illiteracy. You've probably gathered that from now. But when the first humans arrived in Australia, what was it, 70,000 years ago?
Yeah, something like 60, something, yeah.
How do they have the same shared, and how do we all have the same shared ancestors from 5,000 years ago? My brain is melting at this.
It's not a stupid question. It's a good question because it is exactly the question that you should be asking. Another example, so I'll give you very briefly that the people who migrated and became the indigenous people of Australia basically walked there because the sea levels were much lower due to various ice ages at that time. So, and then they get cut off as the sea levels rise and Australia becomes an island and the islands of Southeast Asia become islands. Same thing happens in the Americas. About 24,000 years ago, there's just continuous land between what is now Siberia and what is now Alaska. The Bering Straits we refer to as the Bering Land Bridge. And the indigenous people of the Americas just migrated from Asia into the Americas. At some point in the last 20,000 years, the sea levels rise, the Bering Land Bridge becomes the Bering Straits, and the people of the Americas are cut off from the rest of the world until, well, 1,000 years ago, Leif Erikson turned up and stayed for 3 years, but they didn't have any kids there. And then 1492, until Columbus invades. Then you say, okay, so just like you said with the Aboriginal Australians, how can the indigenous people of the Americas have shared ancestry with me and you when they were separated from the rest of the world 20,000 years ago? And the answer is because the first thing that happens when Columbus turns up is, well, basically raping the local women. And we talk about gene flow, which is the flow of genes from one population into another. And as soon as the descendants of the first generation of people who had European parents, European fathers and indigenous mothers, as soon as that happened, those children have all the same shared ancestry as all of the Europeans that have come before them. And what happens with that same exponential explanation that I gave about two parents, four grandparents, and so on, the same happens in the other direction. Genes spread remarkably quickly down lineages as well. So now there are no people in the Americas or Australia who don't have European ancestors. And if they have one European ancestor, it means that they have the entire umbrella of shared global ancestry. So if Columbus had never turned up in America, then the answer to your question would be 20,000 years rather than what it actually is, which is about 4,000 or 5,000 years.
You've been absolutely fascinating. We've got to stop. But before we do, I want to ask you what sort of has been burning in my mind while talking to you, that what's very clear is that you demonstrate what binds the human race together, not what rends them apart, which is a very positive message. But you are also quite scathing, quite clear about the things that do tear human beings apart that are extra racial, if you like. And you're heavily involved in the humanist organization, Humanist UK. Yeah? And it strikes me that I wonder if part of that is because once you've worked out how to argue with a racist, and once you've made it really clear to us all that this is all just absolute nonsense and that human beings are effectively all have a great shared ancestry from really not very long ago. It's not that difficult to conceptualize 1,000 years in Europe or 5,000 years in the world. What's left are the things that tear us apart are ideas, doctrinaire ideas, and they tend to be, although aren't exclusively, connected around religious rites. Is it fair that that might be partly what draws you to humanism? Because it's another kind of bridgehead in the battle line of getting people to stop being at loggerheads with each other.
Yes, I suppose it is. I mean, one of the key tenets of humanism is that we have an empiricist mindset. That the natural world exists, supernature does not exist. And we seek understanding of the universe and our interrelatedness and our social relations through science rather than through anything which could be deemed supernatural. And that is appealing to a scientist, because if you are of no faith, if you're, I'm an atheist, I don't think there's any evidence for the existence of supernature. And the ephemeral nature of the various gods that we've had for the last 10,000 years, I think is a good demonstration, you know, a sort of logical demonstration of that, what I think is a fallacious set of ideas. Again, though, we come back to power. The imposition of religion upon societies and the resulting conflicts that come from religious doctrine are really about the maintenance of power, and historically, especially in the Abrahamic religions, are about the maintenance of power of men over women, mostly. And so I think in approaching subjects like this, or in writing about the scientific history of race and trying to explain what race is from a scientific point of view, I am not pretending that I'm going to fix racism at all. It's a much more specific claim that, or much more specific aim, is that I'm saying that you can't have my toys to defend your bigotry. One of the things about studying history, and you'll know this as a classicist and a historian, is that bigotry is perpetual, but the nature of the bigotry changes over time. Just like we were talking about at the beginning of the conversation, Rome and ancient Greece were empires of enormous conflict and great violence. They just happen to be a different set of people fighting with the different sets of people that we would do today. So the bigotry continues, but it just shifts according to the prevailing power structures of the time. We just happen to be living in an era where the concept of race is still only 300-400 years old. But to people who don't study the history or don't study the science, it feels like a very real biological thing. We see people of different skin colors and we say, you are a different type of person to me. We see people succeeding in one sport but not in others and say, that's a good thing. Well done for being good at that sport, but it's because you're a different type of person to me. And so my approach is to go, well, is that true? Why do we think that? Sometimes students or members of the public ask me, well, do you feel optimistic about the future of scientific racism or racism in general? And I think the answer is basically what I've just been saying, that yeah, I do. I do feel optimistic on the grounds that there isn't any more reason to believe in the biological construct of race today. And the biggest barrier is scientific understanding. Does that mean that prejudices go away? No, of course not. But history shows that the types of prejudices mutate according to the prevailing culture. So in a sense, you know, How to Argue with Racists, it was a book that I'm very proud of and enjoyed writing. But my aim is that in, I don't know, 20, 40, 50, 100 years' time, it'll be totally redundant and it'll be a book only of interest to historians.
Tackling one prejudice at a time, that's the best we can hope for. Adam Rutherford, thank you so much for joining us on Inspired Minds.
Thank you, Dan.
You've been listening to the latest episode of the Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series with me, Daniel Norcross, and my fabulous guest, Adam Rutherford. You can listen to previous episodes of the series on all major podcast platforms. And if you enjoyed listening, don't forget to like or subscribe. To find out more about the series, just go to rathbones.com.
The Rathbones Inspired Minds podcast series now available on all podcast platforms and at Rathbones.com.